saw the Facebook of you standing on the desk doing your foot mechanics.
You know, sometimes you just get a little shock and awe to the crowd, and it kind of gets attention and, make people think. So
it happens. And that's what you're best at.
Shock and awe.
Right.
But no, I was just mentioning before that, you know, if something works out in the summertime and I can get over there and do a in-service for you guys for the program at all, and or if we can coordinate things for next January for the marathon, you know, I'm happy to work on that with you guys.
Yeah, and we're also part of, the Ironmans, the half.
Yes.
I think that'd be great. I think that if we can get you involved between the marathon and the Ironmans and get you in touch with some of the folks at Memorial Hermann, I think that'd be a nice partnership.
That'd be great. Happy to help.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you agreed. Nice
well,
to
you know,
business fit.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Nicole and I were just mentioning about was that, you know, she said, you know, they don't get this type stuff about footwear. Because I told her, I said, I brought all kind of goodies with me. You know, I got really, you know, big Hoka shoes. And then I have little Merrell shoes and kind of all stuff in between. And, you know, going through school and, you know, this, I don't think there was a whole lot of focus on running mechanics related to footwear and how it can impact the way we move. And so a lot of it, and I just know this because of the world that I live in, is I just kind of learn in the real world, you know, kind of trying different things and seeing, okay, do I like the shoe like this that's really got a lot underneath of it, or do I like a shoe that's skinnier and more in touch with the ground and get better proprioception? And everybody's different. And I don't think a textbook or a classroom is going to necessarily help you understand that. I think it's sometimes it's just kind of...
Yeah, you got to be able to get out there and learn. You know, the way I learned about this was at some point in my education, I came across a podiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I just spent some time with, you know, a day or so with that podiatrist, and I learned about how the foot moves and the shoes and all those different things. And in today's world of athletic training education, you know, there are so many educational competencies and proficiencies out there, and you're trying to meet all of those. And so we have a clinical education day that we meet like on a Friday, and we try to bring in professional speakers, and we're always looking for ideas of how to improve. And so we'll you know, maybe on a Friday we can get you over here and talk about it. But in the meantime, my suggestion to Nicole or anybody else like that is you've got to be able to facilitate your own learning sometimes and be able to get out there. And Nicole's great at it. She's done a good job of going to learn about some of the things that she's interested in outside of the education. But students need to be able to be proactive participants in their education. And they've got to be able to go and say, you know, I'm interested in how this moves, and I'm going to go learn about this. Because the way, you know, as you know, Ryan, the way that athletic training education works now is we have to be able to teach competencies and proficiencies, and we're going to try to provide as many adjunct experiences as possible, but we can't get them all.
Right.
So,
absolutely.
So let's take that and let's start from the beginning so we can get everybody up to speed. Tell us a little bit about you and your background. Start from the beginning. You went to undergraduate where?
At the time, it was Salisbury State University in Maryland. Now it's just Salisbury University. It's a school on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, Division III school, so a smaller school. So one of the things that I really liked about that education, and it was accredited program, Pat Lamboni, still the head athletic trainer there, so they've had consistency through the years, but you had a lot of, it was an internship program, so you had a lot of experience and hands-on experience with it, and so I really, you know, that get kind of, I liked the fact that I had to kind of be resourceful, and you know, you mentioned about kind of finding your own education. Students today need to kind of, you know, still learn things on their own and not be spoon-fed. And I think that because at the time I had a Division III, smaller budget, smaller pool of resources, you had to really be creative in how you handled your clinical responsibilities and your education. And I think that has kind of set the foundation for me now as I have moved forward. After finishing at Salisbury, came down to Louisiana State University, LSU in Baton Rouge, and very different experience. Big Division I program, huge Division I program, and I worked women's gymnastics and football in my time there. And so, you know, at that point, you know, you have a lot of you have a lot of resources. You have a lot of you could get in and talk to doctors and therapists and everything at a moment's notice. And so I think at that point I started to understand, okay, I have all this great information. I need to kind of really understand it better and tap into those resources. And then as those resources expanded, you know, I got to know, I had an interest in running. My background's in running. I ran my first road race back home in New Jersey at age 12. And I've done it on my own for years and years and years. And so I'm like, how can I take this sports medicine and this enjoyment of running and understand it more and understand the way the body moves? I've always had a fascination with the way that the body has moved. I mean, that's why I got into athletic training. And so that kind of after I got my master's degree at LSU and was finishing my doctorate at LSU, I went up to UNC Wilmington. I was clinical coordinator at UNC Wilmington in their athletic training program. And then I had a kind of a unique opportunity to come back down to Louisiana and help open up a second location of Varsity Sports. So I worked part-time at Varsity Sports in Baton Rouge through grad school. So I had the chance now to come back and actually be manager and then a managing partner there in Mandeville, where I am now, and really take that kind of unique sports medicine, athletic training background and use it day in and day out with our customers and have a chance to talk to podiatrists, because now I could talk the talk with all of them. I'm not, you know, I can talk sports medicine. I can talk the way body mechanics are. I can educate them about footwear and how it can maybe help their patients. And same thing with physical therapy and chiropractic work and orthopedics. And so it kind of gave me a different level of credibility when I went into these practices and say, hey, we have this great specialty running store. We sell shoes and other, you know, fitness gear, but mainly, you know, specialty running shoes. We do go through a specialty running kind of fit process. So it kind of piqued their interest in that, hey, you know, this person can, you know, kind of talk on the same level of as us. And that really just has excited me through the years and kind of helped spur on some further education, understand the mechanics of running better and how it works with different shoes. And so so we opened up that store in 2007, and you know, 2016, we're still going strong. And so it's been a fun ride.
And you're still functioning as a managing partner at Varsity Sports?
That's correct. Yes. So
you know, you bring up a couple different themes here. One is technical credibility, right? Because of your background and education and credentials, you're able to sit in a room with other medical professionals and, as you said, talk the talk and walk the walk. You know, we want to be able to function in the village of medicine. That's how I kind of term it. And you also bring up another unique dynamic that you kind of have a non-traditional pathway that you were going down, and you know, you followed that post-professional graduate assistant. You went on for your PhD because you had some more questions. Mm-hmm. And then you started off in athletic training administration and then had this unique opportunity. And that forced you into understanding the business of what it is that you're doing. And so talk about how, I want to touch on a few themes here. Talk about how your understanding of the business has helped you become a better clinician.
Well, I think the one thing too is, you know, we know that, well, the first thing I want to touch on is you had the discussion with Mark Merrick a couple episodes back and about the village, you know, being the village of athletic training and sports medicine. I think that's so right. You know, we have to put ourselves at the same par with other medical professionals, and they have to recognize that athletic trainers, we are healthcare professionals. You know, we intervene when somebody has an orthopedic injury. We understand the importance of life-saving techniques. So there's a lot of things that we do as athletic trainers that I don't think people recognize. And so I think that's something great about March every year is that there's a lot of focus then on athletic training during the month of March, and people are really, their eyes are really open to, hey, wow, an athletic trainer does that, an athletic trainer does this. And so so I really like that discussion you had with Mark about what athletic trainers do and how we can add credibility in the workplace. And so when it comes to the business that I am in, I have to understand budgeting. I have to understand marketing promotions. I have to understand staffing. And really it comes down to dollars and cents as far as that goes is, you know, how much staff is too much, how much is not enough to be able to serve our population adequately. You have to go through the training of the staff as well. And so one of my main responsibilities is any new staff is get them up to speed on what we do day in and day out the shop, but then also to take them into the mechanics of running, take them into the way that shoes are constructed and built. And so from a leadership perspective, I have to kind of be in charge of, I'm the head athletic trainer at our practice, so to speak, at Varsity Sports. And so if you think about what a head athletic trainer does, and though they may have great people that work underneath of them, they are ultimately responsible for that program. And so that's kind of the same thing with me and day in and day out. And so we have other business partners that are owners as well. But you know, having a great team there with me and just making sure, okay, if I give this person the responsibility to, you know, let's say in the clinical athletic training world, prepare for practice. Okay. They're the sub chair or whatever of getting ready for practice. I have an employee that might be in charge of making sure that all of our compression gear and socks and so forth are taken care of. And so, you know, kind of delegating responsibility is certainly something that I have had to learn to do, because I can't do everything all the time. You know, I'm at the shop as much as I can be, but there's times where I'm not, because I'm out at a physical therapy clinic doing a workshop, or I'm at a local business of 200 employees doing a lunch and learn, so that they understand what we do. So it's kind of the outreach as well, and getting our name out to the community, and that, hey, we're a reputable business. We do things that are different than many other sporting goods stores. And we have a great qualified staff. And so I think that's, if you think about the parallels of the business of what I've been doing, and also, you know, credibility of our knowledge base, it's kind of the same as athletic training. We have to continue to get ourselves out there as credible sources for, in our world, specialty running, footwear and gear. So I think it's really kind of helped me understand that dynamic and how to make sure it all works.
And you've, correct me if I'm wrong, you've stayed involved in the teaching and research world. I think you're teaching a class at Southeastern Louisiana University. Is that right?
I am. That's correct. I have a endurance and running class on Monday evenings now. So I leave the shop a little bit early on Mondays and go teach that class. So it's kind of been neat for me, because I pull on a lot of the people or resources that I have developed through the years of the business. Now it's, okay, well, let's see if we can get an education like that to the students at this university. And so there's been a good relationship there between our business and the university. But it also too has kind of kept me involved on the academic side, because sometimes you can get very retail number oriented, a lot of businesses that happens to them. And so this has kind of been nice in that it's kind of kept things fresh and current, so that I can bring the academic or research side back to my staff at the shop and say, you know what, guys, we've been thinking about shoes this way. Let's think about it a little bit different. Let's understand this part a little bit more, so that when a customer comes in, we can educate the customer. Because one of our big platforms is educating the customers. And so if I can kind of take that teaching and research background and desire to understand to my staff, the staff then understands it. And then, you know, we're a totally different entity for the community. So it has been fun being able to kind of combine the business and the teaching/research side of things. And again, I just think it's unique. I don't know a lot of other people that do that nationally in my specialty running world. I think I've met two PhDs in the specialty running forums that we have, and maybe two athletic trainers. So it's kind of been fun for me to kind of put myself in that spot to help out.
All right, Ryan, let's talk about the class you teach on Monday night, so we can kind of learn about the mechanics and the things that you teach them there. So how does that normally look?
Just like any class, you have a curriculum, different topics and so forth. And so one of the we use running as a platform for a number of different things. And so one of the things, of course, is how the body moves, you know, and so one of the things that is great is everybody has heard of, or at least heard of, but probably read the book Born to Run, Chris McDougall book, you know, mid-2000s, really opened up a lot of people's eyes to running mechanics. And if you're not familiar with that book, that is, he had suffered with injuries for years and years and years. And current research has about 80-85% of runners get injured annually. And so he wanted to kind of look at why that was the case and why so many people get injured. So he went down to the Copper Canyon in Mexico and looked at this group of Indians, the Tarahumara Indians, that had run on super, super skinny sandals and like loincloths and really not a whole lot of anything and were rarely ever hurt. You know, you don't see them in a walking boot. They're not on crutches. You know, they're not in wheelchairs. So why are they able to run for hundreds of miles and not get injured? So he looked at them. And so that got a lot of people thinking about running mechanics. Irene Davis and Dan Lieberman up at Harvard University have a big, big lab. Irene's the head of the Spalding National Running Center up there. Mark Cucuzel has looked at running mechanics through the naturalrunningcenter.com. And then somebody the local that's gone big national, Jay DeSherry, who is a physical therapist from New Orleans, that now is one of the foremost gait gurus in the country. This kind of group and it's expanded to others have really looked at running mechanics and how we can lower the individual, lower their chance of injury. And so understanding the importance of hip movement and how getting that hip to open up more, using the glutes more, you know, one of the lessons that I teach is kind of the evolution of man as runners. And so we have developed some very unique traits that you don't find in other species where we use our glutes a lot. We have very little hair on us because it helps. We're more efficient sweaters. We have a long Achilles tendon, which contracts and bounces back like a big spring. And so there's a lot of, you know, kind of there's one of the lessons, Jeremy, is evolution. And it's not what your religious belief is. It's just how man has developed to the point we are and our stature now and what kind of muscles we've used and how we've, as runners, we can use those a lot to get better. And so if we hone those parts of our bodies and make sure they work correctly, our chance of injury, and there's trends that show this, there's chance of injury goes down. And so that's something that I think that you'll see research start to look at in the years up ahead of us is, you know, looking at, okay, if this person has X amount of hip extension, will they lower their chance of low back injury or Achilles tendon issues? And so the tough part is, and I try to tell the students this as well, is that it's tough to zone in on one part of the body because running is so complex. You know, we're only as strong as our weakest link. And so if you think about our bodies and you know, I've had kind of chronic Achilles issues that I've learned to manage because I think because I'm a runner and because I'm an athletic trainer, if we can learn to manage those better, we can move more efficiently. So it helps the students understand, okay, where have we come as runners? How's our body meant to move? You know, of course I'm sitting down right now and we're all sitting down right now, but you know, thousands of years ago, sitting was a very, it was not something that was done very often. And so people's hips were not tight, their Achilles were not tight, their backs were not tight. And so there's one class where I'll have the students stand up for most of the class. And when we talk about the mechanics and they're like, oh gosh, this, you know, this feels weird. This feels so foreign. And so it gets them thinking of, all right, well, if I'm supposed to stand up the whole time, how come I don't do that all the time? You know, how come I sit and I'm dormant? And, you know, we all know this, we sit in front of computers, you know, all the time, like we are now. And we, you know, our bodies are not, or get kind of bound down. And when I go out to run, I get injured. And so we look at posture, we look at how we'd have developed as man, as athletes. We, of course, look at footwear, you know, because that's something that's my bread and butter. That's what I know. And so, you know, I bring in shoes from the super, super skinny Merrell shoe that can fold up and bend into like somebody's pocket. To something real big and thick like this Hoka shoe with a lot of protection. And so it has people thinking of, okay, well, why is one shoe better than another? And so that's one thing that I'm interested in is seeing the impact. And Josh, this gets back to what you asked about, you know, the research side of things. So it kind of keeps it fresh for me is what impact does footwear have on the way we move? And so there's studies out there. And again, I bring a little bit of this into the class, but I don't get too far into it because it would be kind of complex to go over, but what impact does footwear have on the way we move? Because there's studies that show barefoot versus shod or with shoes. Well, most all of us are wearing shoes these days. I bet all of you guys that are watching this or listening to this right now have shoes on. So how in shoes can we move better? And I think that's really kind of a key point, key component that I try to drive home with the students, because as they walk around campus, they can notice the way people move in their footwear. And so we go through those lessons. We go through that equipment. We talk about other things. We talk a little bit about nutrition. We talk a little bit about other training programs. But the part that I repeat, even if it's just for a few minutes every day at each lesson, is moving better. And that kind of, to me, that kind of gets into the prevention side of athletic training, is that, okay, if I can prevent somebody from getting hurt, you know, I'm going to keep them on the field or the court longer, and they'll move better, and I'll have less time loss, and then I'll have to take care of them more on the backside, you know, less on the backside. So for me, it's kind of a intricate web of combining all these things together, but I try to break it down pretty simple with simple lessons for the students to just move better, day in and day out. So there's a number of good topics that I pull on.
So let's talk about briefly, Ryan, let's stay on that trend of the mechanics of running. Talk a little bit about how, incorporate ground reaction force into the kinetic chain and how that's starting to break the anatomy down and create some injuries.
So when you run, you will land or impact with about 2.3 to 2.5 times your body weight. And the research has showed this time and time again. And Jay DeSherry, when he was at University of Virginia, had a gait lab with a force plate treadmill. And this force plate treadmill was actually tuned to the way it would, the way the ground was outside. So it didn't give a lot. I mean, it was spot on. So 2.3 to 2.5 times the body weight. Every time you hit the ground and push into the ground pushes back against you, the ground reaction force. And so if you're a 100-pound person, you're pushing into the ground with 2.5 times your body weight, 250 pounds. And so if our muscles and tendons and joints and ligaments are not tuned to handle that, over time, the cumulative stress will cause it to break down in many cases. So how do we get the body to move better so that we can lessen the what's called the initial peak initial ground reaction force? So if everybody hits the ground with 2.3 to 2.5 times your body weight, that's not going to change, okay? But how can we reduce the initial spike of that ground against our body and reduce our chance of injury? So an analogy that I like to use is that if I have 250 pounds of pressure pushing against my forehead, okay, I can either get that pressure with a hammer and either get the pressure and just push gently against my head till I achieve 250 pounds of pressure, or I can take that hammer and just bam, whack that head, okay, in a quick, very violent kind of action. Does that make sense? So versus an easy push versus bam, just hit it very, very hard. And so more times than not, our head could handle that amount of pressure if it was just the gradual pressure up to 250 pounds. But if you took the 250 pounds of that hammer and quickly hit the head, something would happen very, very bad. So the body is kind of the same way. If we can reduce that impact peak or that initial stress and kind of soften that a little bit and lower that angle of that stress, our body can still handle the 250 pounds of pressure, but just the rate or delivery of that load would be less, and there'd be less impact, less stressful impact on our body initially. And so if you get a graph Dan Lieberman has or Irene Davis, you can see this graph really, really well. There's a big steep initial peak to it, and then it actually, you know, kind of dip a little bit and then kind of come back up. And I think I have it on my website too. It's a really good graph that I use often for even for customers to help understand this. Lowering, Josh, that initial peak is kind of a big thing for reducing impact. And so sometimes it's through running mechanics. So one big thing that we talk to folks about is not overstriding. And so if you run and overstride, and I'm going to try to turn you guys around so I can do a little, if I can kind of show you a little bit here too. I don't know if anybody's going to be able to see this, but I'm going to try to show this. All right, let's see. So versus if I run and my foot's way out in front of me like this, can you guys see that? Like that. And I hit the ground this way, relation to my center of mass. All right, that's a very hard angle to hit. Can you guys see that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. But if I pull that foot back towards me and kind of soften the knee,
okay, and soften the Achilles a little bit, it's going to be more like a spring. So think about this. If I go like this, it's like taking a broomstick handle and constantly throwing it into the ground, into the ground. Eventually, this broomstick handle is going to break. All right, so that initial peak that I talked about is hard and is going to break that angle. But if I have something soft that kind of gives a little bit and I land with the same amount of force, but I lessen that initial peak on my joints, I'll have usually less incidence of injury because everything's softer now. It's like a bunch of springs. So that's something that we try to tell folks all the time, and is an easy thing to do. It's just don't overstride, pull that foot back underneath of you and kind of give and bounce a little bit more so. And so there's different techniques to do that with. And a lot of it is easy. If you take your shoes and socks off and go run, you're not going to overstride because it hurts, right, to land on your heel on a hard ground, like an asphalt or concrete ground. But if I bring that foot back and land here and use the big spring that I have in my arch area, use the big toe to kind of provide all that spring, I'm going to know, okay, automatically my body's going to be in a better position to not get hurt because I don't have a lot of the shoe protection. Okay, a lot of this big, thick shoe protection here anymore. It's just me and my feet. So our body has an amazing way of kind of putting itself into a good spot to not get hurt. And so it's tough to kind of describe over Skype, but when you can get out and feel it, it makes a big, big difference.
Is there a rule for how far in front you should or you should not stride?
Nicole, there really isn't. There's some... it's not like, okay, you need to be 6 inches in front of your body or 12 inches. There's really not. And that would be great if we could quantify that and say, okay, you want to be no more than 6 inches in front of your body. But if you think about all of us, we're also individually different. And so overstriding for one person is not overstriding for another. And so it's a tough thing to quantify. It really is. What I would say, honestly, is try to get your foot as close back to your center of mass or your belly button area. So your foot's back underneath your center of mass as you can without feeling like you're falling over. Because sometimes so think about a Segway, you know, those two wheel little jobbers that you stand up on. So if the wheels are here on the Segway, okay, and this is my head, and those wheels are out in front of me, okay, I'm going to stop, okay, I want to put the brakes on. If I have the wheels right underneath of me and I want to keep going forward, okay, I can probably roll pretty easily down the road that way. But if I have the wheels behind me too far, or in other words, my feet are too far under my center of mass, I'm going to feel like I'm falling forward the whole time and or a sprinting kind of motion. So it's tough to really quantify as to where those feet need to land. I would just tell folks, if you can go someplace and get kind of videoed, and the great thing is that there's a lot of, you know, with all the technology now, iPhones have really good slow motion video that you can just look at. If your foot is extending and your knee is straight and not bent a little bit, chances are you're the broomstick and not the little spring-loaded area. So that's kind of a roundabout way of saying there's no quantified number that we have seen for how close your foot needs to land.
Do you think there could be one that uses maybe percent body weight or maybe even height percentage?
Length of your stride, yeah, or something like that? Yeah, you know, I bet that's a great research question. Josh, you need to get your students looking at that. It'd be one thing to look at.
So going back to some of the things that you're talking about, I'm trying to keep up with you. First of all, tell everybody, you know, you had mentioned that there's some great information on your website. What's your website?
Rundocryan, rundocryan.com. And, you know, I'll keep up with, you know, I'll put some interesting posts up there that I think are pertinent to health, you know, and really it's kind of I use running as a platform, but I'll go into nutrition a little bit. I'll go into other aspects of kind of health and wellness, kind of like athletic trainers. We cover all aspects of keeping people healthy. And so that's what I've tried to do with it. So it's on Facebook as well. And there's some different information there that's even more current. And, you know, so that's where I kind of link in. I have some really great partners around the country that I'll try to pull some of their information into as well, because they're the ones that are doing the research and are working right next to shoe companies at the development side. Jay DeSherry's got a site, An Athlete's Body, that it's got some really good info that I can take some of that info and break it down to the everyday use for what we can do. And so there's some good information there.
And so going back to the app, you know, at NASA, a couple of the athletic trainers at NASA, they use an app called Coach's Eye.
Love it.
Yeah, you do. So for, you know, if people are going to end up evaluating biomechanics and movements, mm-hmm. tell us the advantage of an app like Coach's Eye and why it's so important to, you know, say in the athletic training world where we're trying to prevent injury, what are some of the benefits of that?
Well, you can look, and Nicole, this would actually be something that you could use with kind of determining if somebody's overstriding and how far back they might need to have their foot is. You can you can look at joint angles. So you can kind of put markers on different parts of the body and draw lines between them and look at joint angles. So if you have somebody that, you know, is really running with a very straight knee and you say, okay, I want you to kind of increase the angle on your knee a little bit and be a little bit softer knee, a little bit more compliant knee, you can over time begin to look at that joint angle and see how that changes and give them some real feedback. And so sometimes what I'll do is I'll take somebody out on the road in front of our shop. I'll say, okay, go ahead and run, and I'll record them on my iPhone and then drop it into that app, and we'll look at some, I'll quickly look at some different angles, and okay, then I'll say, okay, now take off your shoes and socks, do the same run, and I'll record them again, and I'll drop it into Coach's Eye again. So I can look side by side and have the person look side by side in a matter of minutes in a very, very mobile setup. And they can really see, wow, you know, that having my shoes and socks off really changed things. Now, if I put my shoes back on, do I go back to running differently, back to running with shoes on? And so that's something that I think is a very applicable everyday thing to that we can use as athletic trainers. And then I have a master's student, Cedric Scotto, that just finished his master's looking at folks that ran in regular shoes and then went to a real skinny shoe and how their running structure, their running mechanics changed with and without shoes. And so if you have folks that are doing that research and then us every day kind of get that Coach's Eye and drop it in, we now have the backing, the kind of knowledge base to break this down to the everyday person. And I think that's the really important thing, is having apps and things that are very applicable to the community and the everyday athlete is so important to get that research out and use it. So Coach's Eye is a great thing, Josh. While you can't look at impact forces, because I don't know that it ties in with the force plate treadmill, and most folks don't have those. If you just have a force plate, there's different software out there that you can use. But Coach's Eye is great because you can look at images side by side. You can look at angles. You can do it on a mobile device very, very quickly and easy.
Now, I've used Dartfish. Is that one comparable?
I've used Dartfish a little bit as well. I think that that's a little bit more complicated, and that's why I think I've gone back to Coach's Eye. Coach's Eye is for a year, might be $40 for a subscription, and you can do it across multiple devices. Dartfish, it seems like it's a little bit more, and you may have used this more, Nicole, a little bit more lab-based. But you know, I've seen it used out in a real-life setting as well, but I just know Coach's Eye has been pretty easy to use every day. How have you used it, Nicole?
With running analysis videos.
Yeah.
I've used both Coach's Eye and Dartfish, and they seem pretty comparable to each other. Coach's Eye did have a more simpler interface, if you will, compared to Dartfish. So I'd say for starting out, maybe someone can go to the Coach's Eye and then maybe get into Dartfish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen Dartfish use a lot more on the kind of the research side and bigger institutions that might have more dollars to do things like that and have more of a reason to use it. Coach's Eye, again, is super simple. You know, even somebody that's in my world at a retail business world can use it, or somebody that doesn't have a lot of financial backing can use it. And it's very easy to use. And, you know, you give the person a little bit of information, you know, the angles and how they move, and they can see it kind of real time. You know, it's pretty nice.
How important are other measurement tools like a pedo barograph and other measurement tools of the foot in what you're doing?
You know, I haven't had a reason to even thus far, haven't had a reason to look into any of that, because in what I'm doing, I get so limited time to kind of do a full biomechanical evaluation, because let's realize too, this is a business, you know, and so you don't have appointment time set. You know, you could have my staff, you know, and I, we could have 8 people come in at noontime and have nobody come in at 4 o'clock. It's just the nature of business. So you have to realize too, you need to be accurate but efficient in what you're doing. So
I haven't had a reason to go beyond coach's eye to use any other measurement tools. Some businesses may have kind of a physical therapy side or clinical side of things where they may use something a little bit more detailed. And then, okay, immediately, literally, they're going from the clinic, we'll walk 5 feet, now they're on the retail floor, the sales floor. And so that may be something where they need a little bit more detailed information. But in what I have done, coach's eye has really been great. And you know what? We don't even use a treadmill anymore because it's nice to get somebody running over ground, you know, real world. I mean, I think it's much more applicable.
So let's talk about briefly now, we talked a little bit about the mechanics of running and foot strike and ground reaction force. Now let's talk about how the shoes play into those types of stresses and forces on the body. Mm-hmm. So first, can you walk us through how does the foot react when it's running? Everybody knows about, you know, heel strike, supination, pronation, toe off and walking. And then we know about, you know, the float phase and ground reaction force. But talk us about the true anatomy and biomechanics of the foot, the stresses that are being relayed back up that tibia and fibula, and then talk about the shoes and how, you know, why is it so important to know what shoe? And by the way, going back to a comment that you made about 2.5 times, you know, while you were talking, I did some calculations. You know, let's say you got a 350-pound lineman that's coming back, you know, for that's 875 pounds.
Right.
That is a lot of weight coming back on the person. So, you know, you're just reporting for camp or whatever it is, and you maybe you're a little out of shape, you haven't run, and all of a sudden, you know, you're sprinting or you're running, that's 875 pounds back on, you know, the body. Of course you're going to have some injuries.
There you go. I mean, I think that if you can break it down that simply for an athlete and that why it's important for them to come into camp prepared, that's why I think, too, that I remember that at when I was at LSU working preseason camp, you know, the first couple of weeks, we would have a lot of hip flexor groin issues because that tissue wasn't able, what the athletes weren't ready to handle that stress. And as they kind of trained into, as their body kind of trained into the session, we had less and less of those because, all right, now the body, you put some stress on it, it reacts and gets stronger, you put some stress on it, reacts and gets stronger with, you know, Wolf's Law. And so, the body, if somebody, you know, has to handle 850 pounds of pressure, it's relative. So if you have a 100-pound person and they're only handling 250 pounds of pressure, they may be ready for that. But if you have a 300-pound person that's handling 850 pounds of pressure, they may be ready for that. But if not, you know, they may have the same rate of injury that the 100-pound person has if they're not trained. You know, I mean, so again, I think that it's relative in the person getting ready for their activity. And that's where, again, where we as athletic trainers can say, you know, prevention is so, so important. Before you go home for this summer, you know, maybe you and the coaching staff work out some things that these are some things to prepare the body to come back for the preseason camp. And I'm sure a lot of programs do that. But I think when you can put it into numbers like what you just did, I think that'll hit home with folks. And so if you have... So let's go to mechanics a little bit. So if I have the foot that is a spring, it's a movable dynamic spring. And most folks think too that like the arch, for example, when it hits the ground, it doesn't move. Okay. And so you look at something and you know, the arch may move 1.5 to 2 millimeters. Some research shows that it's not much, but it does move. It's got some movement in it. So as our foot hits, if our tibia is coming up off our foot like this, okay, and our weight comes down, our arch has got to depress a little bit, okay? Because it's part of the natural shock absorption and shock dissipation process that happens in our body. So if it's not allowed to do that, to bend and flex the way that it is, kind of like a leaf spring on a trailer or a car or something, and that gets locked up, then if that shock dissipation is not allowed to happen, where does that shock have to go? So And this comes into footwear. So if I have my arch here and I have something up against the arch that is locking that arch up, okay? If my arch wants to bend and flex and can't do that, then now that shock that comes down, again, we'll use 2.5 times your body weight, where does that shock have to go? Well, it may go back up the tibia. So if we talk about, you know, stress fracture type issues, or it may go further up the chain and get into the knee joint. And, you know, you see a lot of, you know, medial compartment medial knee pain for folks as well. And you know, we know it's a big chain of events, and so it'll go to the weakest link. So if that person is strong in their lower leg for some reason, but the weakest link is their knee, they may have medial knee pain. Or if they're predisposed to knee issues because of their genetic makeup, they could have knee pain and issues there. So the body has to be allowed to be just compliant enough so that it can move and dissipate shock and get ready for the next phase of gait. You know, from initial contact, and Josh, you mentioned heel strike, and so I think it's worth talking about. Not everybody heel strikes when they hit the ground, you know, and so we were probably taught decades ago, stride out, hit with your heel, and then roll through. And now, again, because of all the attention that's being paid to mechanics, some folks land midfoot, some folks land forefoot. I think that allowing the foot to be compliant and do what it's supposed to do will help and aid in whatever part of contact you're hitting with, will allow it to dissipate shock in a pretty natural way. So when that foot hits, they're hitting, you know, initial contact, and so right there, that's an impact peak we talked about earlier. Okay, that big initial peak. So the foot will bend and flex as it becomes more compliant as we go through mid stance. So mid stance is where our body's center of mass is over top of our foot. It's kind of hard to demonstrate here, but where our body's center of mass, so our belly button is over top of our foot. That's where peak pronation happens. So you mentioned supination, pronation. So when that body comes through, it's not when we first hit the ground that a lot of people think is where our foot's going to move the most and pronate or supinate. It's actually where when our center of our mass comes over top of our foot, and that's where the peak amount of pronation or supination occurs. That's what's been seen in a lab, you know, through much of the research that Irene Davis and Jay DeSherry have done. And so at that point, it's like, okay, that's where, you know, that mid stance is really where we need to kind of look at if the foot needs to be controlled or just cushioned a little bit, or really where there's a lot of attention to mechanics needs to be paid. So that's single leg stance in running. That's a single leg stance phase. So then the body comes through that part and has to kind of push off back at the Achilles and at the glute to kind of push itself forward. You asked about resources, online resources earlier. A great way to explain what and see it visually, if you go to naturalrunningcenter.com, this is Mark Cucuzella's site, and go to Principles of Natural Running. It's a fantastic 8-minute, 24-second video about running mechanics and everything we're kind of talking about, but it puts it into graphics and video. And it really helps kind of break it down, explain it. And I'm constantly referring folks to that site because it really makes it very, very clear. So that's kind of where, you know, we talk about foot compliance and glutes firing and hips kind of opening up as they push your body through. It kind of all comes together in 8.5 minutes.
And so when you talk about how that foot is moving, a lot of people that would experience some sort of foot pain, you know, medial longitudinal arch, mid tarsal, et cetera, they're automatically going to go search for an orthotic. And so there's a big science that goes into orthotics, you know, to go to Dr. Scholl's and just slap one on may cause a bunch of other issues. So talk us through a little bit about how orthotics is going to manipulate the biomechanics. And then let's keep moving on into the shoe wear.
Sure. So the one thing I want to say is that orthotics have their place. They absolutely have their place. Mostly I see for somebody that is genetically predisposed to a certain type of injury. Okay, so if grandma had shin splints or she had arch pain and you know, dad has the same thing, you may be, because of your physical, your anatomical makeup, you may be more predisposed to that. So if you have some sort of congenital defect and need that area to be, that therapy won't handle, you've tried therapy and won't handle, an orthotic may help to kind of accommodate or support that foot that maybe your body is not able to do. So what does that mean? So if you have somebody that has a flatter foot structure and has some associated injuries further up the kinetic chain, possibly by giving them some help with the orthotic under the medial aspect of the foot, that can help change their mechanics and take stress off, you know, some parts further up, further north of the foot, you know, into the shin, into the knee, into the hip. The thing that, and you know, mentioned it, you know, don't just go to a Dr. Scholl's and say, oh, well, you know, I have this foot pain. I'm going to see what it says. Okay, I'm in you know, F45, that's the install I need to pull it out and I'm good to go. That's looking at a part of it. You know, you need somebody or people to look at your whole person and how you move. And that's where something like, you know, Nicole Coach's Eye is helpful, because you can look at the body in multiple planes, multiple ranges of motion, kind of get a full picture of it, and then decide. And then you can put almost like little shims or little adjustments of the orthotic and say, does that change the mechanics for the better? And I think that's the important part. Okay, yeah, orthotics are going to change how somebody moves, but does it change it for the better? And does it change it so that it helps accomplish our goal? Not just, I have arch pain, slap an insert onto it and be gone. You know, that'll take care of things. No, you know, take a look. It might take some shuffling of things back and forth or adding more to post it or taking out some to accommodate a different area. So I think you really have to have a good orthotist or physical therapist that really has an understanding about full body movement and mechanics, and see if that orthotic is going to be helpful. So then if that person, the flip side of it too, is that orthotics can certainly change things for the worse. And you know, sometimes it can cause more knee pain. And maybe it's not somebody that their anatomical makeup warrants an orthotic, but maybe if they have a weakness. And a lot of folks associate weakness with, okay, I need to put something further into the arch. And that's where an orthotic commonly gets prescribed for the long term. And so I have folks, for example, that the number one injury that I see is plantar fasciitis. Absolutely, by far, both doctor diagnosed and patient or customer diagnosed, because they've been on WebMD or they've been to, you know, Google Doc or something like that, and they've figured out that that's what they have. And so they come in with plantar fasciitis and they say, well, I got this doctor prescribed me an orthotic for plantar fasciitis. And I said, okay, well, that's fine. Did it help? Yeah, it helped. It's better. Well, when did you get it? I got it 7 years ago. So I talk to them and I say, okay, so when did it go away? Well, it went away about 3 months after I got the orthotic. Great. What did you do to get that foot better after? Nothing. So you've kept your orthotic in your foot since, in your shoe since then? Yeah. So I tell them, I say, okay, you're in a car accident. You sprain your neck. You have a neck brace on. Do you leave that on for the next 7 years? And they're like, well, no, duh. I'm like, okay, well, it's the same thing happening with your foot. So I think that what folks need to understand is that orthotics can help them get better, but let's figure out a way that we can get therapy and get that foot stronger again, get it more dynamically stable, and then let's see if that helps take care of things. Because a lot of times, too, it's just a weakness. You know, we are in shoes. A lot of folks are in shoes that are, you know, they have the wrong heel to toe angle, and this will segue into what you're going to talk about in a second, Josh. Heel to toe angle. They're in toe boxes that are too narrow and kind of pinch the feet. And so that changes how their big toe works, and that changes the strength of their arch, and that changes the neuromuscular control they have between the big toe and all the other toes. And there's a great thing, and Josh, you talked about this before we went on air today. I usually, in a lot of the talks that I do, I will bring up a thing called toe yoga, and I'll jump on a table and I'll show how the big toe moves and the little toes don't. It's not my research and my exercise. I give full credit to Jay DeSherry and Mark Cucuzella, that they have found that if you can get that big toe to move independently and strengthen that and kind of be like a kickstand for that arch, it will keep everything kind of strong and stable. But I mean, I talk to so many patients, customers, clinics that I go to, if you could simply get that to move, it's important. So, yeah, I know that last week, Josh, you saw it when I did a clinic. They had it; they put it up on Facebook, and there's a YouTube video that everybody should check out too. Are you ready to go minimal? And that'll talk about the big toe and the importance of the big toe. This was 2011, I think it was done, that Mark and Jay did it, and it shows how to separate the two of them out. So when I have somebody that comes in to ask about an orthotic or an insert, I'll also make sure that they are doing toe yoga. And doing some one leg stance, just single leg stance and balancing as well, because all those things tie in together and they might not need an orthotic or an insert for the long term.
Would you say that's more of a motor control or motor pattern issue or like a strength weakness problem?
I would say it's probably more a motor control issue, because if you try to get folks to separate out their great toe from the other four digits, it is really hard for folks to do. You know, I had 30 people in a lunch and learn last week,
And it was like folks were concentrating, they were wrenching their eyes and trying to get, they're trying to concentrate and get their feet to move. It was hysterical. And so I really think it's a neuromotor control thing, which I think if you start to get that, if you start to accomplish that goal of separating those out, I think then the strength and stability comes along with it. But I think it's a neuromotor control thing for sure. And again, I think it goes back to a lot of folks and the footwear that they are typically in, whether athletic footwear or not.
So before you transition to the footwear, Ryan, you know, in athletic training school, people learn about orthopedic tests like navicular drop, feast line, or fest line. And so for everybody listening and start to scaffold all this information, you get a navicular drop or you get a positive feast line or fest line, then the first thing to go for is orthotics, right? But they need to be measured first. So start to scaffold all that information together. How does one play into the next, and how does that help you prescribe the right shoe?
So for a while, navicular drop, you know, it was a real simple test, of course, with the index card and seeing when somebody is seated at the height of their navicular, and then when they stand up, how the navicular position changes. And even in our world, meaning the retail specialty running world, that was kind of looked at for a little while, but it was seen as almost kind of a static measurement for folks. Even though you were moving a little bit, it just didn't it didn't resonate very well with folks. Okay, what does that mean? My navicular is dropping a little bit. What does that mean in my footwear in the way that I move? And so when you were able to then take, you know, kind of say, okay, this is how your foot moves. You have either if the navicular moved a bunch, then they, in your head, you may have said, they have a pretty mobile foot. So I may start to guide them into a shoe with a little bit more structure to it. But I think since then we have realized that even a pretty mobile foot can be pretty strong and solid and have good neuromotor control. And so I rarely ever see that used in my clinic, my retail world. It's really now, how is single leg balancing or stance, how good are they at that? How good are they? 30 seconds, they start to get tired. Do they waver? Do they have a positive Trendelenburg's test? Although nobody in retail specialty world calls it that. But, you know, okay, is their glute medius weak? You know, so we start to look now at when the foot is loaded, how that person starts to waver with their eyes open, with their eyes closed. We don't so much look at numbers with that anymore and say, okay, well, your navicular is dropping a tremendous amount, but your hips are solid and stable. I think the solid hips and the strength of the glutes are much more important than how much that foot is kind of moving. Because if you look at Haile Gebrselassie, former world record holder in the marathon, if you ever look at some of his video footage and watch his foot hit the ground, and typically, I think it was the Berlin Marathon some years ago when he set the world record, they looked at his foot and his navicular was slamming into the ground every single foot strike. And he's got a paper thin racing flat he was with. But if you look too, the level of his pelvis was completely solid because everything from on up was just so strong. And he, because he grew up in Ethiopia, had developed a very strong, he had a mobile foot, but a very strong foot. So he therefore too, he had very strong glutes and hips to kind of control that. So I don't think that looking at things like navicular drop is as important anymore, because now we're looking at the whole chain and the way everything should work. We probably should have been doing that 15, 20 years ago, but better now than never.
Sure.
So, I do, you know, there's some times where we certainly look at the person walking. Okay, we watch the way that they walk. We watch the way they stand. We watch the way they walk. We do look at the way the foot kind of moves. But then also too is now if they start having issues, you know, let's take them outside and look at them in a little bit more dynamic setup. So it's kind of a progression of evaluation. So there's not really just one thing that we look at. And you know, as athletic trainers, we don't look at just one test that says, okay, this is absolutely their injury. But it kind of is ingredients into our pie to make a good pie. You know, if we have one ingredient that is off, it's going to be a bad pie. So we have to make sure everything is good and we get positive tests and we have a good diagnosis coming out of it.
So let's take that information and start to work on shoes. Mm-hmm. So now you've got a situation where somebody's come to you and they've talked to you about, I need a new shoe. I've got this pain or that pain. I'm just not moving. Talk about how shoes are constructed, and then talk about how you prescribe one shoe over the next.
So I'll take this shoe. I have, this is a New Balance shoe called a 1080. And so the different parts of the shoe, I'll just go through those real quick. So I don't know if you guys cover any of that stuff in your classes. You have the outsole where the rubber meets the road. You have the midsole here in this kind of white red area. And that's kind of the cushioning or stability component of the shoe. It just kind of depends on what the shoe is made for. You have the heel counter back here that kind of helps hold the heel. It kind of helps hold the heel into the heel of the foot into the shoe. Of course, you have the upper, and that helps hold the shoe onto the foot, and the toe box too. And you think, okay, great, toe box. Why is that important? Well, like I mentioned earlier, you have to have enough space for that foot to splay out and get that big toe to kind of move and do its thing. So shoes now, I think you're seeing even kind of mainstream shoes like this New Balance shoe, the toe box is wider. And you know, you want to have some flex of the foot with the shoe. And so those are the parts of the shoe. So kind of from concept to sales room floor could be 18 months to 24 months of development. You know, from initial kind of design all the way to when, you know, you see this coming out of the shoe box. And so there's a lot of biomechanical testing that takes place. I've been fortunate enough to go and see some of this and talk with footwear developers and see what they're kind of thinking about even 3 years down the road. And so, you know, so there's different creative things that are being done. Yeah, so New Balance is using a thing called fresh foam. So instead of the traditional foam that's what's called EVA foam, they have a different type of foam construction where they have concave and convex materials in their shoe, and they can tune that to what the shoe's supposed to do. So they won't necessarily right now tune it to, okay, you're a 250-pound person, you need to have X amount of cushion in it. You know, no, this is, we know that this shoe, the 1080, and by we, I mean like the sales associates, this is a 1080. It's their highly cushioned shoe. We'll keep that in mind, and it won't necessarily be for one type of person as much as, you know, you can be a 300-pound person, you can be a 100-pound person. You may both feel equally comfortable in the shoe depending on your body's biomechanics. So that's where now it comes back to body biomechanics. And the shoe is just a protection between the ground and your foot. So when we look at somebody that, you know, we'll do our evaluation, like I said, we'll watch them standing, we'll watch the way they walk, we may watch the way they run, we'll have them do little single leg quarter squats and see how their foot changes and moves, what happens to their shin, what happens to their knee, does their hip dive in? And then we begin to get an idea as far as what direction to go to as far as footwear. We'll also talk to the person and say, do you have any injuries? You know, what's, again, plantar fasciitis is probably the number one issue that we see. Well, what have you done for it? You know, kind of a lot of the same questions that we as athletic trainers ask. You know, we get a lot of history. I'll, you know, palpate a little bit and kind of do touch and feel their foot. We'll do some of that. So we'll get that history. And so all this kind of goes together into the big mixing bowl and says, okay, I have all these things going on. As I go back into to our stock room, my job is to understand what each pair of shoes is supposed to do, what kind of features it has. And then I bring out, you know, four or five pairs and we try some different things on and you get immediate feedback. And the biggest thing too is what feels most natural under the person's foot. So I think if you start to have something that's pretty unnatural feeling, first of all, they're not going to wear it. We know that if it's not comfortable in the person, they're not going to wear it. And then also too, is it may be doing something too abnormal for the foot to accomplish your goal. So we try some different things and, you know, they can go outside and run or do what they want to do in the shoe and see how it feels and kind of break it down that way. So some of the shoes are stable. Some of the shoes have a lot of cushion. Some of the shoes just have a little bit of cushion. It really kind of depends on what we're trying to accomplish. But having somebody trained that knows what the shoes are supposed to do, what kind of qualities it has and how your body is supposed to move and how they all work together is kind of key to making sure it everything works right.
And so talk about, you know, when I was going through school, we talked about shoe construction and the different lasts.
Mm-hmm.
right? So talk briefly about why the last is so important and how it provides the foundation for the shoe.
So everybody has a certain foot shape. And what that means, and that's basically foot shape or foot last. So some feet are wider, okay? And you want to have the base of the shoe provide a good base of support for the foot. Not support like extra structure, just if I have a foot that the base of the shoe is like this, and my foot comes down over top of it in this way and kind of sits on top of the foot adequately and supports all the parts, all the metatarsals, everything of the foot, I'm going to be better served than if I have a footbed that's pretty narrow and my foot is wider. You see now how I would kind of be coming off the edge. Sure. So it's like putting a piece of plywood on top of a 2x4, and the 2x4 is in the middle. And if you stand on the plywood, you're going to rock back and forth. Okay. Versus if you have piece of plywood on the ground and you put the same size plywood on top of the previous piece, it's going to be pretty solid and stable. And so the last or the shape of the shoe or the shape of the shape of the shoe should match the foot pretty darn well. So that means that we need to have the adequate width all the way through, wide enough in the toe box, and adequate stable platform back here on the heel for it to support the foot in that way. So the last is still something that's looked at. You know, somebody has a pretty narrow foot, they don't want a last that's real, real wide, because they're going to feel pretty sloppy in the shoe, and vice versa. If somebody has a pretty wide foot and they get a shoe with a pretty narrow last to it, they're going to feel constrained pretty quickly and uncomfortable pretty quickly. We still, even after all these years, Josh, we still look at the last of the shoes for sure.
So now let's talk about the different types of shoes. Why one over the other?
I think one question that I always ask folks is, do you like feeling the road or have some connection with the road, or do you want to be totally dissociated from the road or trail, whatever surface you're on, and just want a big layer of cushion underneath of it? And that's where I think that shoes, for example, that are like here come in. We have a big thick Hoka on one side and a thin Merrell Vapor Glove on the other. And so somebody that prefers to have a little bit more connection with the ground, wants their proprioception or balance to be a little bit better, may prefer something a little bit skinnier. And so there are shoes like this Merrell Vapor Glove, the Ultra One, and they're all pretty flexible. Topo has a shoe that's got, you can see it's a little bit more padding now than that Ultra was. I'm sorry, than the Merrell was, but it's still pretty flexible and still pretty wide. So there's shoes that have a little bit more cushion than others. And then it kind of works its way up to, okay, even more cushion, and then kind of a maximum amount of cushion. And I really think it depends on what the person's preference is and what you're trying to accomplish. If you have a big lineman, you can stand to put a kind of a bulky knee brace on the person, on the lineman's knees. But if you have a running back or a receiver that needs to cut and be very, very mobile, having a big, thick brace is not going to serve them very well. So same kind of thing. If somebody prefers to just, they're kind of trotting along and just wants to just have a lot under their foot for padding wise, they may work better with something that's a little bit thicker, like a thicker Hoka or more padded New Balance, versus somebody that wants to stay pretty nimble. Maybe they're doing functional training type work. They need something that's pretty flexible and move. I mean, you can really literally, it's just a couple ounces, this Merrell, and you can pack it up and it's very flexible and let your foot do its thing. So I think then it comes down to preference, first off, is the amount of padding underneath the foot and the amount of shoe underneath the foot. And then also too, what we see as the practitioner, the sales associate, whatever you want to call us, as what might be beneficial for that person for the situation that we're in. Do they have any injuries? Are they lacking kind of a fat pad in the bottom of their feet? You know, as we age, our fat pad tends to deteriorate. So maybe that person needs a little bit more padding. So those are all things that you have to kind of ask the person. And a lot of folks, and especially that's why shopping online is so dangerous, you don't get asked those questions. And so having the in-person evaluation and fitting is so, so important.
All right, Ryan, we also have Bubba Wilson. He came in kind of during the show. I think you might have seen him sitting next to Cole. So Bubba, say hello.
Hi.
All right.
Hey, Bubba.
So there were a couple of questions. Basically, I want you to make it identifying running mechanics for dummies, right? So just make it real simple. Somebody that doesn't, like me, know this stuff really well, looking at running mechanics and identifying the angles and those kind of things. And I don't remember ever having any sort of class on running. So, for me, if I take, you know, coach's eye, well, I don't even know if I'll do that because it's like you said, $45 or something.
But so here's what you do. All right. You don't even need to use any of those apps or software. I'll make it real, real simple. First thing is that you have somebody run with their shoes on and do it on a firm surface. So do it on asphalt or concrete or something of that sort. Because when you run on a field, because there's padding there on the grass or the turf, it's kind of a false sense of security as to how they should run. So get them to run with shoes on, then and have them try to catalog in their head and have the athlete catalog in their head how they feel and for you to kind of see things. And then have them take their shoes and socks off and run the same surface. And so the biggest thing that I see, the biggest change is in shoes, most folks will overstride. And like I said to Nicole earlier, that foot will come out way in front of their body and they'll hit the ground. And we don't need a force plate treadmill to tell us that we have a lot of force slamming into the ground. Okay, so if I can get them to shorten their stride ahead of their center of mass, okay, so not overstride, and have their hips open up behind them, behind their center of mass, that's going to be more effective for probably for injury reduction and actually using muscles and joints that are supposed to help you run. So not overstriding is the big thing. So if you're watching somebody run and you see them, their foot looks like it's really, they have a big inclination angle towards the sky at their ankle. You know, that's a pretty good indication that if you slowed them down and went further up the kinetic chain and went up to their knee, you could probably see a pretty close to a locked out knee. And therefore, then there's not a big bunch of springs in there kind of absorbing the forces, and all that force can go up through the shins, through the knee, into the hip, into the back. And so if they're having back issues, it may be related to how they're running and how their foot is contacting the ground. So I think the big thing for clinicians, without having anything fancy at all, is make sure the person's not overstriding. I think that's a big, big thing. That would be the number one thing that I would probably look at too. And then two, I would say if you can get them to jump rope and you see that they're pretty light on their feet versus kind of heavy on their feet, mm-hmm. then if they're light on their feet, chances are they have a pretty good spring mechanism that doesn't need to be trained, just needs to kind of be honed in a little bit. But if, you know, again, we'll use Josh's example of the 300-pound lineman, they might be a little bit heavier on their feet and might be landing with a lot of force. And so that may be a simple thing to do is, hey, just let's get out and jump rope together. Let's see how you jump rope. Let's see how you move. Let's see how you bounce. And if you land flat footed or land on your heels and you have to push back up versus landing on the front of your foot or the, you know, kind of the ball or mid part of the foot and kind of bounce and you're real light and springy, that may be a good indication that they need a little bit of help in their running mechanics. And so that would probably be two quick and easy things that, you know, everybody can do in whatever type of setting that they're in.
Okay, so if someone needs to be lighter on their feet, what are we going to do?
You can give them some verbal cues of land like a ninja. You know, they're like, what do you mean land like a ninja? Well, land soft. You don't hear a ninja, right? They land very, very soft. So as you run, I don't want you tiptoeing, but I want you to think about landing with less impact, land softer. Okay, so you can tell them land softer on the ground. In my practice, what I do every day, I work out of a redone house from the 1890s. So over here in Louisiana, most of our houses are raised up off the ground, so that wooden floor can echo a little bit. So if I have somebody run or walk across the floor, and I can hear them slamming into the ground every single time, I'm like, all right, we need to kind of soften you up a little bit. We need to kind of quiet you down a little bit. So, you know, whether you get out to a basketball court to a wooden basketball court to do it, or some type of surface where you can hear an echo, if you can tell them, okay, run up and down this court and you don't hear them, okay, because you told them to land like a ninja or land very, very soft. And it sounds kind of silly, but I mean, if landing soft reduces the amount of force, the impact force on their body, that's a quick verbal cue that would be helpful for them.
Those are the same kids I think you hear if you're on a track, you hear them coming from 20 meters away. You know, it's like, here comes so-and-so. You know who it is because they're just slapping the ground the entire time.
And that's a key word, Bubba, is kind of slap, because what they'll do is they'll come in with that foot at a pretty high ankle angle. They'll hit and their foot will just slap right to the ground, versus if they come a little bit softer, a little bit flatter to the ground, their foot, okay, that spring I talked about earlier, will kind of give and be more compliant and absorb some of that sound or some of that impact. So, yeah, you could almost, for your sake, kind of close your eyes and listen. And if you hear a foot slap, that's probably going to be the good indication that athlete that you have is landing pretty hard.
I want to go back to shoes real quick, because I know in my time at the high school, and I dealt with some really, really good cross-country programs, and we had a ton of kids. You know, it went back to, I'm a simpleton, it's straight last, curve last. You know, mm-hmm. Are you a pronator or supinator? I can teach a kid how to look at a shoe and do that, at least, if they're not going to go to somebody that's going to watch them and evaluate them. And we can't control where they go. But I think one of the things that was totally missed by kids and parents and whomever alike, and I think this is where an insole or something helped, is the width of the shoe. They love the color design of the shoe because that's why they buy it, let's be honest.
Sure.
It fit them lengthwise, but the upper was coming together at the top, and it's still, you could take that shoe off their foot without unlacing it. And to me, that did them a disservice, you know, from a biomechanical protective mechanism. The shoe's not doing what it's supposed to do. And that's where you put something inside to take some of the space away. It actually fit them at that point, or fit them better. And I know that's one of the things that, you know, we'd harp on. You can't buy it because you like the design. It's got to fit your foot, you know, not just in length, but width, and, you know, do you have an arch or not? So
yeah, good luck, Bubba, with telling a high school kid they can't buy it because they like the color or the design of it, right?
I know.
You know, one thing that you could do, and certainly, you know, and this is where the parents come in too, and, you know, kind of working with the parents is important, is that, look, I'm gonna recommend some things that I think are gonna help your child be more injury free and healthy longer. And the high school kid doesn't want to hear it, but the parent will help in this regard. And so, if you can get that shoe, honestly, the fit, you know, so we're bringing if the shoe's too big and they're bringing the laces together at the top, and the top of the shoe's coming together, and you want to put something to fill up space in there, but you think it's going to alter the shoe too much for how it's supposed to move on their foot. You know, honestly, there are brands that you can get the same shoe in an arrow. And so that will kind of help.
Right.
You know, so that's something that you as a healthcare professional and the parent need to kind of work on for the child. And there, you know, that's where having some footwear knowledge is probably important, especially, again, if you're in a situation where you don't have the luxury of sending them to a specialty running store. Is that you can say, look, this brand will have some narrow options. I think you should look at them for the overall health of your child. Can you add stuff to it, an insole? Sure. What I would say is make sure it's not an insole that has any sort of structure or stability to it, because that will change even a neutral shoe.
Right.
And by neutral, I mean it's just a layer of cushion, but allows that foot to do its thing. It will change how that behaves or how that functions. And then you're talking, now you're really changing the mechanics of the person and not just trying to fill the shoe.
So no, it usually was after they came in with their new shoes and they don't fit you. Go spend another $15 to $20 and let's go put this in to at least take up some of that space and at least let the shoe fit your foot from a width, you know, from a width standpoint.
Sure. And we have to be practical. I mean, they're not going to go back out and buy another pair of shoes.
No.
So you're right. So a $15 or $20 insole just to take up the space in there may be the answer. You know, I would say if they can get that insert and then wear it for a couple of days and then come back to you and you guys talk about it some more. I mean, sometimes inserts, it's a process.
Right.
You know, like I said with Josh earlier, it's, you know, figuring out how much posting to put in. This is from usually a custom perspective, how much posting is getting put in, how much the foot's being accommodated for and so forth. And so, you know, so really off the shelf inserts can kind of be the same thing, especially if you're trying to fill up a shoe. Because look, let's face it, budgets are a big deal too. So if somebody's buying a shoe size, two sizes too big because they want to have time to grow into the shoe and not have to get a shoe every 6 months, then, you know, I mean, you got to try to help and think about that.
Right. It is what it is at that point.
It is what it is. Yeah. Good point.
All right. So I got a question. is there a rule for when shoes should be replaced after so many miles, so many months, after a certain amount of wear? You know, it's easy with tires, but how about shoes?
Well, if you think about it too, merely our feet are, I'm sorry, shoes are really the tires for our feet. And so the kind of industry, specialty running shoe industry standard or guideline is about 6 months or about 500 miles. So most folks, unless it's cross country or track, are not tracking their mileage. You know, the recreational runner probably will. But 6 months is a pretty easy thing to do, two pairs of shoes a year. Now, there's a lot of variables that go into that as well. If you take your shoes off and put them in the trunk of your car, and we're down here in the South and it's August, okay, the heat will certainly wreak havoc on the shoes. Also, too, if you don't let the shoes dry out, sometimes the bacteria that kind of builds up in the shoes can wear away at the material. So you can certainly wash your shoes, soap and water, whether it's by hand or whether you can put them in the washing machine, a light cycle, take out the insert, take out the laces. Some folks have seen that because they keep their shoes clean. It doesn't wear the shoes down quite as much, but don't put them in the dryer because that will wear them down in no time because, again, that heat will play havoc on it. So some folks can extend the life of the shoe that way a little bit. If they are hard on their feet, you know, if they run really heavy, Bubba, like you said, if you can hear them slapping and coming down, you will probably, they'll see a lot more stress on their shoes in a shorter period of time than somebody that is softer on their feet or landing like a ninja, because you're requiring, you're calling then on the biomechanics of the body to land because you're landing softer than to the shoe to deaden the force, which, you know, over time that will wear down. Let's face it, this shoe, not a living, breathing object. Okay. Once it starts to break down, it'll continue to break down. The materials will not regenerate. Okay. Will not bounce back. It just does. That just doesn't happen. And so there's multiple third party sources that have told me that. It's not just me making something up, but, so with all that kind of happening, all those variables going into it, there are just, again, some general standards, 6 months or 500 miles. But you know, there's some different things that kind of pop up in the footwear. So what I tell folks too is look at the midsole of the shoe, okay? If you start to show signs of wear or compression, so what does that look like? Well, and if I was able to show you, let's see. If I can compress this material together and I start to get creases in the midsole of the shoe, then that means that the shoe is starting to get compressed or wear down. But you know, think of the wear signs on the shoe are like the rings of a tree. So the more rings of a tree that there is, the older the tree is, the more creases or wrinkles there are in the midsole of the shoe, the older that the shoe is, and probably the more worn down the shoe is. The thing about a tree is it can regenerate. Again, shoes, like I said, are not living, breathing, cannot regenerate. So those are some signs of wear.
Yeah, we always talked about with our kids is they were running twice a day in season, so
yes,
that wears them quicker. That early morning run was in the dew and the moisture with the high humidity here, like you guys experience.
Yes.
And then the other thing they never think about, it's the same shoe they wear to class, so that's mm-hmm. wearing that shoe down as well. So that we always told them 300 miles because it's really going to be about 4 when they really thought about replacing them. So you know, we try to buy a little time in there too.
Yeah. Always thinking ahead. Absolutely. Yeah, because I tell folks too, you know, I have let's say soccer moms that come into the shop. So they've gone to do their workout. They've come home. They get the kids. They run the kids to school. And then they run errands. They stop in to see us. They run some more errands. They go pick up the kids. They're still in the same shoes. They think, well, I just used them to run 30 minutes this morning. But now they've used them from 6 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock at night. They've been in that shoe for 12 hours. Who knows how many miles they've put on it just in, let's call it living miles.
Right.
Not just the 30 minutes they've exercised in. So you're right. So for that woman, I may say 300 miles, 400 miles, full knowing that because her life is so busy, I might see her at 550. And I've given her the warning, so to speak, of, you know, you need to change your shoes out pretty regularly and talk through it. But at the same time, knowing that won't happen. Yeah, if you can buy yourself some time and kind of help them out and explain why it's so important to trade out the shoe, I think that you're doing them a service, which is good.
All right, you said the number one injury you see is plantar fasciitis or something related to that.
Yes, correct.
What did you say was kind of your fix or your, I guess, your number one way to correct that?
So the biggest thing, that's kind of funny that we're having this discussion right now. My wife will probably kill me for this, but the bottom of her feet, her one foot, and she's had on and off plantar fascia issues for years. It might last a couple of days. There's a great device called Correctoes. CORRECTToes.com.
Yeah, I think you posted a picture with that, like your feet were on the dashboard or something.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We were driving Disney World, and so I had my, you know, I wasn't driving for a while, so I had my feet in the correct toes. So it actually gets in between the web space of all the toes, and it actually opens everything up. So this kind of goes back to what Nicole was saying about having neuromotor control and keeping everything spread and separated out. And so this is a device developed by a podiatrist, Dr. Ray McClanahan, Northwest Foot and Ankle out in the Pacific Northwest, obviously. So he ran at elite level, worked with a lot of elite runners. And so she can put this device on in about 2 or 3 days, and she'll walk around in it. She'll sleep in it. It will open up that foot enough that it almost kind of retrains in my mind, and I have nothing research-wise to tell me this, but I can see this just from me using it and her using it and other athletes. It almost kind of retrains the movement of that big toe and gets that plantar fascia to kind of realign itself and re-educate itself, because now we're letting that foot work in a very spread and open kind of way. So for me, that's probably the number one thing that I'll recommend. And then second thing, of course, is toe yoga. It's probably complementary to correct toes, you know, just separating out the big toe from the little toe. And, you know, we always do towel crunches, right? We do marble pickups. We do straw pickups. We do those things. And those kind of work the smaller muscles, and actually kind of go up the foot and up the shin. But when we can work like the flexor hallucis brevis and longus and really kind of get into that foot and stabilize that foot, not everything up the shin, but that foot and control how it moves, that will in turn help control the way the plantar fascia moves. And so if you go to that, I referenced earlier, Are You Ready to Run Minimal with Jay DeSherry, he gives a really good graphic explanation of it. And that is why anybody that comes in with plantar fasciitis, those are the two top things. Correct toes is number one, and probably 1A is toe yoga. Those work best for me. And then, you know, folks, you know, we'll get different things to roll out the bottom of the foot. You can go from as easy as a golf ball to really the thing I like to use a lot is roll recovery, R3. You know, some roll recovery is that the skate wheel kind of massage tool. Okay, they have a thing now you can roll on the bottom of the foot. It's fantastic. It's really, really good. And so I'll use that a bit as well. So those are probably all the things I put into my recipe for plantar fascia healing.
All right. You also talked about the hip drop. How do you like to train specifically runners to strengthen the abs and the hips and the glutes? Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, if I do see the hip kind of drop, the simple thing is just doing kind of a hip hike exercise. And you can, you know, of course you can do it off the step or you can do it off a little block or something like that. And really it's just a matter of, letting the uninvolved hip, you're standing on, let's say, the left leg. So the left glute med is what I'm trying to strengthen. Letting the right hip drop down, okay, and then hike it back up. And so that'll kind of really get that glute to fire and kind of help to stabilize the pelvis. I'll do a lot of bridge marching work as well. And not to feel it in the low back, but really feel it in the glutes. And so a cue that I give is that I will almost have folks, as they're marching, lift their toes up. So they're kind of pushing their heels into the ground. This is the one time I'll advocate heel striking first, is that pushing the heels into the ground will actually help their glutes fire and strengthen first versus feeling it in their back. So those are probably the two things that I think have worked to help glute strengthening in folks that I see a little bit of a deficiency. And they're simple things to do. You can do them at home. You don't need a gym. But if you get better at it, doing hip thrusts off of a weight bench where you put like a 45-pound weight on your kind of your pelvis area and letting the hips drop down, and then use the glutes to kind of fire and lift the pelvic area back up. So those hip thrusts are good. You can do those with a big rubber band. You can do this with a plate over the kind of pelvic area. Really just helps to fire those glutes. That's when you get a little bit more advanced. But with all of these, you don't want to feel them in the low back. You want to feel the glutes fire the glutes. We know glutes have a lot of muscle. Let's use them, wake them up.
Yeah, side plank is also a good one too to work that.
Bubba, do you do that when you do the side plank? Do you have them raise the upper leg off eventually too?
And then I'll actually let them drop, and we'll try to make them bring themselves back up into that neutral spot as well. You know, to work it that way.
Sure, but you know, and you know, actually, that's a good point. It makes me think of something. So with letting the hips drop in a side plank, when they go to lift back up, so they don't feel it in their back as much, I have them push. So if I'm on the right side, I'll have them think about driving the right side of the right foot. So that's kind of the bottom leg into the ground.
Yeah,
and
right.
That actually cues the glutes up much better. So yeah, I like that too. I'm glad you brought that up.
All right, we went long, Ryan. You got anything else? I mean, sure. It sounds like we could talk all day, but
we could. I love talking about this stuff. I mean, it's the world I live in every day, and I'm happy to help folks out. And so, if they want to, if they're in the Louisiana area, want to come see me at Varsity Sports in Mandeville, I'm happy to help them out. If not, you know, you can find some of the information at rundocryan.com or send me an email, rundocryan@gmail.com. And, you know, I'm happy to help via the internet if that works for folks. So it's something that I love and you know, just I've really just found a way to kind of work it into my everyday business. But also it's what I live and breathe personally. So I'm pretty interested and passionate about it.
Very cool. In May, I'm going to try and just get athletic trainer stories. You know, I have quite a few people that log in live every week and, you know, do the download. So I'm going to try and just do like listener spotlights. And if it's okay, I might ask you back to tell another part of your story. I think it's the number 3 on like your Twitter bio where it says like father, husband, and cancer survivor.
Sure.
So just to talk more about that.
Love to.
In May. So I'll keep in contact with you about that. So
that'd be great. Yep. Happy to do it.
All right. Well, I'm going to close it out. Sportshealth.com/SMB. That's where you can enter my friend Bubba, his name for March, or Frio, the official hydration equipment provider for the Sports Medicine Broadcast. And that's the password for April. So sportshealth.com/SMB, and they'll ship you out that gift card if you are selected as the winner. And then me and Bubba broadcasting live at Spats. So Ryan, if you want to take a vacation there, South Padre Island, take the family down there. I understand it's a pretty fun experience, so I'm looking forward to broadcasting live there. So
sounds great.
This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/Ryan Green. So sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/Ryan Green, and that'll have the show notes. And as much as I could type in, is you know, he was talking much faster than I can type. So as much as I could get was there. A quick update on the CEUs. Casey Pyle will email those people that were logged in live, and you'll be able to fill out the evaluation then. So I know everything's been changing. So thanks for sticking with me. Again, the CEUs, Casey Pyle will email you the link for the CEU evaluation. Again, this is Jeremy Jackson from the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. This episode is /Ryan Green. For Jeremy Jackson, Bubba, Sports Medicine Kids, Run Doc Ryan, Ryan Green. That is a wrap.
Well, good. That was fun.
Yeah.
That was fun. So I was trying to think as I was preparing for this, because I knew I was going to have to get up and show some things. I'm like, hey, okay, how can I need like a wider, wider angle camera next time. But you know, that's the beauty of, you know, I've just really tried to set up a good network through the years and with Mark and Jay and some of the other folks that I mentioned, because they have some really fantastic graphics and videos that kind of help expand on what I talked about. So hopefully folks will see some value in that too.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
So
good. All right, well, you guys probably have a busy afternoon over there.
Yeah, I got to edit this and then got to go do my athletic training work, you know.
All right. Well, I'll look forward up on the site. It'll be a couple days or?
I think it'll be a couple weeks before the podcast is. I mean, it's already, you could within the next 30 minutes or so, you could watch the YouTube video or the live broadcast. But the audio, I think it's this point is 2.5 weeks.
Okay, no problem. Sounds good.
Hey, Ryan, I may email you. This has been percolating in my head for about 3 or 4 months to do okay. a PowerPoint type athletic trainer talk about footwear. So I may pick your brain a little bit about some of the different aspects of the shoe and fitting and that kind of stuff. Because I think this is one of those big areas that we have a huge impact, but most of us go, I don't know.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. I did a talk like what you're talking about for Ray Castle over here at LSU. And then he'll be on there Wednesday. And then Linda Bobo at Stephen F. Austin in the fall. And I think folks really I did it. I think Ray streamed it to her classroom. And so I did that then, and it got people thinking, because we certainly don't talk about this in much of our education. And it's an important part, because except for, I guess, swimming, so to speak, but everybody's feet touch the ground.
Right.
And so it's important to understand how the body moves and how feet and how footwear impacts how we move, because we all wear footwear, you know,
right.
And so
it's something as simple as, if you go out to a football practice at a high school and you've got an offensive lineman wearing a receiver shoe, and you're like, why? Half your foot's on each side of the shoe folding over. It's not for you. Well, it's light. You don't need light. You know, you need sturdy.
Well, and something too that, you know, and this comes from my world, is that, you know, so the shoes now are becoming lighter and lighter, but they're not lacking necessarily. They're not lacking cushion or structure or support. They're just finding lighter ways to do that. So,
right.
So as athletic trainers, if we can push the envelope with the shoe companies and say, look, I need a sturdy shoe for this lineman, but he doesn't want weight. You know, so now you can start to develop some different, you can start to work with the footwear developers and say, this is what we need. You know, there's a need for it, and people want it. So how can we work together to accomplish this goal? And so I'm fully supportive of that, because nobody wants heavy. You know, there's studies that show for every 100 grams extra of weight added to a shoe, it's X percentage more in oxygen that's being used. And so I think that if we're trying to have folks work more efficiently, and we can still provide them the support they need or whatever they need in their footwear, it's going to be a better situation for all of us. So,
right.
If it's a matter of streaming in again and doing a presentation for you, like I did with that class in the fall, or there's a couple, you know, classrooms or something that I could be happy to help with, please let me know.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I'll get with you.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Bye, Ryan.
Okay. Take it easy.